protecting Utah's incredible bear's ears from the fossil fuel industry. This is Jim DeBacchus on the left.
An op-ed that calls for turning the cannons on the ship. Mr. Metcalf, take your politics somewhere else. This is Representative McKay on the right.
Love him or hate him, Barack Obama delivers his farewell address. We talk about it today on both sides of the aisle. But first, this news. Good morning, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center, and in the studio with me is my good friend, Representative Dan McKay on the right.
Good morning, Natalie.
And on the political left, welcome back to Salt Lake City, Senator Jim DeBacchus.
Good to be here.
Great to be with you guys. Crazy things happening in the news. I'd like to run through several things, and one of the things that's top of mind for me is this crazy thing that happened this week when the former Chief Deputy Attorney General Kirk Torgerson was arrested to make sure that he'll testify in the upcoming Swallow case. And next thing you know, you see this guy in a jumpsuit. I thought that was just crazy, Dan.
It is so much easier to keep your witnesses here than it is to get them to come back. You know, Kirk is living down in Florida, you know, based on reports in the news. And, you know, trying to extradite somebody from Florida to Utah for a trial and some of those other things when they've made it clear that they're not terribly interested in testifying.
It just seemed like an extraordinary use of power.
Wow.
Jim, did you see the pictures?
I saw the pictures. I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know you could arrest somebody who's not charged with anything to be a witness.
Material witnesses.
And what is the idea? Because they put him out on bail now. I mean, it would make sense to me if they could hold him and then make sure they testify. But it was sort of like just this show of power to show what they're willing to do. And then they let him go saying, you know,
Maybe
you again. Is that
right? That's basically it.
It's
an interesting tool by prosecutors that's rarely used, but is used. I mean,
it sounds like Chicago or, you know, L.A. It doesn't sound like Salt Lake City to me.
So if he were to go home to Florida and not come back, then what happens? The state of Utah has to ask for extradition and they may
get it
or may not?
That's right. Well, it's not may get or may not. Then there's another hearing down there. Is he a material witness? Is he not a material witness? What is he likely to produce? And then it's come back to Utah. I mean, it's quite the rigmarole compared to now he's been arrested. He's out on bail, right?
Right.
We can have him called in contempt of that bail in Florida, and they'll just ship him back right away.
I see him. Yeah, very interesting.
That's the real story. Right?
Well, it just foreshadows what's to come when this Swallow trial begins. It's going to take a lot of news, you know, oxygen.
You know, Natalie, it made me
February, right?
Yeah,
very awkward. A constituent's family called, and I talked to a young man who's in prison now. He is a kind of a con guy in his 20s, and he stole $200,000. And he got 7 to 14 years in this indeterminate sentencing. He has been a model prisoner. He had an inch worth of classes that he'd taken. He has been down there 5 years, and he got his parole hearing. And they said, okay, we're going to let you out in 3 more years. He will have served 8 years. And I thought, you know, he got a terrible thing. He should have gone to jail. The sentencing guideline said 14 months. It just seems now, just in the context of Swallow and Shurtleff, who got out of it because the prosecutors couldn't get the deadlines right. And I think of all of the normal people who are sitting in Utah prisons who don't have $500 bevies of attorneys who just go in and have to plead, or they get a lawyer who's got 50 other cases that day. And I think the justice system sure is tough on people without a lot of money, and it sure is good to people that do have a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, another local item of news, and this for me is like flashback, but we have Peter Metcalf, the founder of Black Diamond, who makes an impassioned speech about Utah's anti-public land stance and how the outdoor retailers, our largest single convention in this city, should not come here because of our public land stances.
I say
flashback because it's been going on since at least 2003.
That op-ed was so ridiculous.
Oh, wow. We got some strong feelings from the right here.
That was ridiculous. I read that op-ed and I was extremely disappointed. First of all, any captain of a ship who turns the cannon on their own ship in the middle of the fight is not worth listening to. number one.
Okay.
And that's exactly what Mr. Metcalf has done, right? So he's like, look, I've made a decision about where this is all going. He's jumped to the furthest conclusion of what the legislature or what anybody in Congress wants to do about the public lands in the state of Utah. And he's jumped to the most extreme worst case example. And he's decided that example that could happen 50 to 100 years from now, we must turn the cannons on the ship right now.
Interesting.
And I thought, in my opinion, without any real evidence of any of his opinions being true, he's just jumping out and saying we should, you know, the outdoor show should jettison Utah. And that to me just represents the worst in political hyperbole.
Jim, you have a response to that?
You know, Peter.
We did get bear's ears, so Jim, it's on a tee now for you.
Peter has done terrific things for our community. He's created so many great jobs. He's a very epitome of what we want.
Then why do this?
This is not Peter's job. This is the state of Utah's job. The Republicans who run this state are schizophrenic. They love our parks. They love our outdoor recreation. They love the industry, supposedly. And yet, they cannot come to the conclusion, which is so obvious now, that the outdoor recreation industry is the future of the state of Utah and fossil fuels are not. And if there is a way to kill outdoor recreation or a way to balance it with fossil fuels and roads and drilling and fracking and not protecting, the state of Utah comes down every single time on the wrong side of what's going to be history. And what Peter's frustration...
On the right side of revenue for the school kids and on the right side of local control of some of our public lands, you're right. We do come down on all those things.
The state simply has its head looking back into the 19th century technologies of fossil fuel and coal. And you know what? It's not going to happen. It's over. We need to be looking toward the future and not toward the past. And the entire energy of the state of Utah, and the legislature in particular, and the governor, is on that dying horse buggy industry. And that's what Peter's pointing out.
Isn't your party going to be in control by the time we get control of the lands anyways, Jim?
I hope so. I hope it happens. In 2 years.
I want to be careful how I weigh in here because I have not read Peter's op-ed.
Yeah.
I was serving as Governor Leavitt's spokesperson when he did a similar thing in 2003.
Yeah.
And I remember how that felt sitting in the State House when I worked for a governor who desperately wanted to get a BLM wilderness bill passed. It was one of Governor Leavitt's regrets in leaving office that he never was able to do
And Mr.
It.
Metcalf did the same thing. He turned the cannons on the ship
again. He basically said we shouldn't be here with the state's policies. And what I don't like is it's been going on for all these years, and there's not enough productive dialogue. And I will tell you, I have I study economics. I have a map that I'm going to show legislators today in a forum that I'm in that shows the tale of two Utahs. And it has, since 2008, counties that have economies have grown, and since 2008, counties whose economies have contracted or gotten smaller. And there is a distinct line between urban Utah and rural Utah and how that map looks.
Yeah.
And we have a rural Utah that's hurting. And Jim says, it's the horse and buggy times and they got to get onto the new thing. It's actually a lot more complicated than that.
It is.
They need a diversified economy and they do need energy and they also need some other things.
And I think what the good senator from Salt Lake is forgetting also is it is upon the backs of those farmers and those agriculturalists throughout the state, especially the rural parts of the state. It is on their backs that we survived for so many years. And now that we, quote, don't need them because the Wasatch Front is sustainable, we're doing everything we can to turn our backs on them. And I, from a transportation standpoint, all those other things, we have the votes on the Wasatch Front to shut the rural district down and not deal with any of their issues and throw them out to the wolves. And that has not ever been the position of the Speaker Hughes. It's not been the position of President Niederhauser, both Wasatch Front guys.
Yeah. Close us out here, Jim.
Okay. You know, the sad part about this whole process is Representative Bishop had an opportunity to sit down. The administration was ready on Sitla lands, on energy relationships, on redoing a whole generational look at Utah lands. They were ready, willing, and able. Bishop couldn't get there. He was only interested, ultimately, in the politics of it. That's why our school kids are going to be in trouble.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. In our next segment, we'll talk about education funding and the upcoming session.
Jim DeBacchus, proudly on the left.
And Dan McKay, I guess, really, really proud on the right.
Today, you sound like it. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and I get a help referee these guys. I had someone say the other day.
Yeah, we're a little more excited.
They said, you moderate both sides of the aisle. I'm like, no. I don't moderate. I contribute. You know, I'm not like just kind of like going back and forth between these guys.
You're not the referee. You got an opinion.
I have an opinion. Jim, I just want to hear from you since you represent the left and have this fine president, Barack Obama, who's going to be leaving office. He gave his final address. Did you listen to that? What kind of commentary would you have on his farewell?
You know, if you didn't like his policies, okay, we could argue about that. But to see that man, that family, that grace, that dignity, that eloquence, that message of hope and
change
was the opposite of what I fear we're going into.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't remember a more dignified, a more classy, a more... just dazzling occupants of the White House.
You have to hand it to President Obama for going through 8 years in office without a major scandal of personal integrity or...
Oh, goodness.
Right?
Look, I personally, if you were to ask me of all the presidents we've had recently what my golf foursome would be, like my ideal golf foursome would be, there's no question I would have Bill Clinton, Barack Obama... And, you know, probably Trump.
Trump,
right? but because I think
that would not be mine.
I think the banter would be amazing, right? It would be a pretty fun deal, and I think that'd be some interesting side bets, right?
Yeah.
But when everybody says there's been no scandals, remember when the president started out, this is going to be the bipartisan president. He's going to be bringing everybody together. And I've got to be honest, I'm a little bit wanting at the end of his presidency for bipartisanship and...
Yeah, he didn't get it.
And us coming together, right? And that's just as much the right's fault as it is the left. I mean, it's not like you can blame one side or the other. But if you look at a presidency that was promised on bringing people together, I keep going back to national monuments or whatever, you can't do things that drive the wedge even further if you're hoping to bring things together. And Obamacare did that, and it haunted... I won't say haunted, it either blessed or graced, depending on how you look at it, his presidency, and that will be a legacy. And if it's a short repeal, that legacy isn't going to last long. And so I just look at it was supposed to bring everybody together, and that was the mantra as he was coming in for hope and change.
Yeah.
And we didn't get it.
Yeah.
Now, from a personal standpoint,
that's what I'm talking about.
He has been an absolute a tribute to the office as far as being graceful and
Yeah, I'm so glad you'd say it because, on the policies you can have all sorts of opinions, but Michelle Obama, those two children.
He really likes his wife. I thought Laura and George liked each other, but Obama and Michelle.
It's got a bit of
they're a team.
It's got a bit of Camelot to it that I really respect.
Yeah.
I can't have you guys without also asking, particularly you, Jim, because you're such a Russian expert, but what in the heck is going on with all of this Russian news and Russian hacking and Russian having intelligence about our president-elect that we don't have and on and on and on? Who would have thought that here in 2017, Russia would loom so large?
Remember Putin's job when he became prime minister for Yeltsin? He was the head of the FSB, the KGB.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, he thinks that way.
Mm-hmm.
As a guy who lived basically a decade in the Soviet Union and in Russia, I know that people were following me. It is part of the culture.
It's what they do. There's this paranoia. There's this spycraft.
And there's this very sensitive, amazing ability to use that in a way that is most destructive toward the other person and beneficial to them. So when they say, or when these reports are that in 2013, when Donald Trump was in Russia in a hotel and there are videos, I don't just believe that. I really, really believe that. Why wouldn't they? And a Donald Trump at that time probably would be unsuspecting. And so that puts us in the position briefly of, Where does that leave America if there are videotapes and if there are the details of financial deals as Putin moves into Latvia or Estonia or Georgia or has any major foreign policy, and the president says, knows that this hostile foreign power has this information which can end his presidency? The Congress has to look at that.
It's a stunning development, Dan. I one time had the opportunity to serve in a Senate-confirmed position and had my little visit with White House personnel where they kind of, you know, check you out. And they want to talk to you about the things sensitive in your background that could be used to influence you or to blackmail
leverage.
You.
Yeah.
Yes. And the way they do it, because you're all the same party, you're all political appointees, they hand you this little clipboard that has a list of the things that you need to disclose.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the scare tactic.
Right.
It's just everything about your personal life. Anyway, the thought to me of...
What was on the list, Natalie?
Oh, yeah. Everything
no,
you can
I'm
imagine.
Just kidding.
But, you know, everything
on your
about
list
financial
is what we're asking.
Morality, I mean, all sorts of things. But I look at our president-elect and I just sit here and think, he's got so much in his background that can be used against him. I believe that.
But doesn't that... Okay, look, I don't know. I'm not going to... I don't have the same faith in Trump that Jim does, that these things are, you know, true and things. But I will say... I think this just plays into Jim's mantra or into Trump's mantra, which is they're all lying about me and everybody's going to believe him.
Yeah.
That's
and,
how he got elected.
And all fake, this news
fake news
becomes this big deal.
So I just think it's kind of entertaining a little bit. I worry about it for all the same reasons everybody else does. But it is interesting that everybody's still trying to come up with some gotcha to take out Trump's knees, to make him a weaker president. Also, it's like this constant thing. And everybody hasn't realized he seems to walk away from these fights with not only his kneecaps, but yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
well,
I'd cut it out if I was those guys. But, you know, and Russia can, you know, can say they're going to leverage Trump. But nobody's been successful in getting that done.
I don't know if anybody has the Mr. Vacillation on every issue from I'm not going to build the wall to I'm not going to kick out the Muslims. He's been consistent about one thing since day one. Putin is good. Russia's good. We're going to have a relationship with them.
It's going to be interesting to watch. That's what to watch is to watch if he can actually turn on them. And if he can turn on Russia, then he's not being leveraged. But if he can't, he's being leveraged. Very interesting. Guys, I can't help this, but it is approaching mid-January and the legislative session is right around the corner. You have a full day meeting on it today, Dan. If I'm
can't
not mistaken,
wait.
The House Republican caucus getting themselves ready. How would the two of you characterize the upcoming session? What is this session going to be known for? What are we going to spend all our time on?
Well, we're 12 days out, Jim. I just wanted you to think about that in case you
I'm going to Mexico.
Prepared.
Jim decided to come back in town. Since
and you're going to Mexico again?
Yeah, I'm going to Mexico.
Are
no,
you
I'll
really?
be back mid-May, March.
Well, I'm leaving for Phoenix next week because, you know, I need to golf before the session.
So what people are saying that are, you know, Capitol Hill watchers is that this will be an education session, and they're saying that because of speaking about leverage, but because of the rise and momentum behind the Our Schools Now plan to put an initiative petition out there to raise our income tax for education.
That'll be the big conversation. That's the big conversation when we go to meetings, you know, and we're talking behind the scenes. Everyone's mentioning the Our Schools Now proposal. What are we going to do about it? How do we deal with it? What are we going to do with the extra money? I mean, people are already starting to write checks, right?
And $750 million this tax increase.
So I'm just going to – I'll just take 2 seconds and remind everybody. Look, back during the Huntsman tax reforms, right – the big Huntsman tax reform, you know, cut taxes and improved Utah's economy. We've seen measurable results as a result of those tax cuts. You can argue whether or not that leveraged the future and those kinds of things, and we can deal with that also. But there was measurable improvement to the Utah economy. And I think when you look at – and it's funny because the way we flattened out taxes back then, it actually benefited the most wealthy. And it is interesting now to see the downtown wealthy turn around and say, well, we need to increase everybody, including – you know, the lower tiered incomes in the state of Utah, we need to increase their taxes just to the benefit of the wealthy. It's just ironic, right? That was something that was pointed out recently. But the other thing everybody has to realize about the $750 million, you know, just because you put $750 million new dollars into the education budget, there's a gaping hole between the education budget and higher ed. And because there's a gaping hole, because of a constitutional amendment that was done several years ago, that was approved by the voters of Utah, because of that gaping hole, the budget is fungible. You can throw $750 brick into the water vat of education and not raise the tide, because that money can scoot over to higher ed, and then we can take the money out of higher ed, put it into something else. I just look at this and I say, without internal structural reforms, this is too early.
Interesting. So, Jim, that was a pretty wonky point. Dan knows
yeah,
the state budget
that.
Really well, but
sorry.
he's just really making the point that you can raise money for public ed, but out the back door you can take money away from public ed.
You know, I'm going to go much higher. You know, when you hit me low, I'm going high here. So.
Look, when I go wonky, he goes intelligent.
We live in a state of denial. The governor, his head is in la-la land. I mean, he's saying,
that's a good move.
We're going to...
Not a bad place to be.
We're going to actually... We're going to get to be in the top 10 academically with no financial plan to get us out of generationally being 50th. As a matter of fact, less money per student in real dollars now to each Utah student for K through 12 than when Gary Herbert got in office. Think of how shocking that is. Now a group of wealthy people are coming back and saying, we're in a crisis. We want to raise everybody's state income tax by 0.7%. Here's my caveat to that. My dear wealthy friends who have this great idea that I would be in favor of, pass my bill, which says everybody that makes more than $500,000 a year will go back to the Huntsman days and pay 7%. That will not end the state of Utah as we know it. But guess how much money that will bring in? $287 million if we take those 18,000 people and we say, you know what? You've been the great beneficiaries. You guys have done well. You're going to go back to where Huntsman was. That's going to get us more than a third of the way. And before you go back to that family of four struggling in West Jordan and in Orem, and ask them to make this 0.7% sacrifice, let's go back to the big beneficiaries and let's claw back and let's raise $287 million. That's only fair, and it's the only way I'm going to support this. And this is the only way I'm going to tell liberals that they can support this tax thing, because you can't go back to the base and have them make a big sacrifice when the extremely rich in our state have been such great beneficiaries. No, it's not fair. And unless you somehow get that tax increase passed, I'm going to tell every progressive person in the state to not support this.
So this is just a little snapshot of what the legislative session will be like, because there's going to be all these sorts of discussions about how to get more money to education, and everybody's going to have a lot of disagreement. And meanwhile, the Our School Now proponents are going to be getting momentum, ultimately getting signatures. And I would predict that this goes to a vote.
I predict the opposite.
Yeah, let's hear it.
I think that they're trying to leverage. They're doing the opposite of what the Count My Vote folks did, who actually just ran up and, you know, said, fine, we're just going to go get our signatures. You got to get 10% of the signatures in 29 of the Senate districts, in 26 of 29 Senate districts, a high hurdle. But I think our school now is hoping that the legislature will just say, out of fear, they'll just jump in and do something.
Interesting. Well, we're going to be talking a lot about the legislative session. I hope we'll be doing some live from Capitol Hill. Dan, you said you have a gripe. I can't wait to hear a Dan McKay gripe.
Yeah.
A thought out
like he's got emotion about it.
Yeah. So William and Elmer Hurst. Okay. Anybody know those guys?
William Randolph?
No. William and Elmer Hurst. They own land out near the Bears Ears that is part of the monument that they had access to for generations. Generations this has been in their family. And they now have to go to the federal government and renegotiate to try and get access to their property that they've owned for generations. That's my gripe. The idea that we can sit back in D.C. and make policies that affect things and we can toss stuff down on people and, oh, it's just a national monument. Oh, we're just preserving these things. No, there's real people who have private land ownership, not just SITLA. So it's not just the school kids. There's these private landowners who got the shaft in this deal.
Yeah, shocking. Jim.
Jason Chaffetz, who turns out runs the committee that runs Washington, D.C., they passed a bill, their mayor passed a bill, their city council passed a bill with a right-to-die provision. Jason says, no, I want Provo values in Washington, and I'm going to kill that, and guess what? He killed it. Talk about federal overreach. Jason, what the hell are you doing? Let the people in Washington, D.C. govern themselves. That's what I say.
My gripe concerns fake news, and I just have to say that, you know, we get fake news, and then everybody thinks all news is bad, and I'm not like that. I believe there are trusted, credible sources of news, and if you follow them and read them, your life will be enriched, and I don't think fake news is being shared by the credible news entities, so I wanted to give a shout-out for real news. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I've been joined by Dan McKay and
like
Jim
Fox
DeBacchus.
News.
Like The Economist.
The program's produced by Ross Chambliss. Thank you for listening.